Hello and welcome to Radio Luke Solicit. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Today is Friday, August 19th, 2016, and this is episode number 6, and the title of this episode is The What and Why of Oligarchy. I've written quite a bit about oligarchy, it seems like, over the past years. That's not a word that I typically used a lot up until fairly recently. But I think it's an appropriate word to describe the situation that we're in here today, that we find ourselves in here in 2016. And so I wanted to expand on that idea a little bit and talk some about oligarchy. One of the things, of course, as you may well know, I am a Clarkian. That means that I am someone who follows the work of Gordon H. Clark, the Presbyterian minister, theologian, philosopher. One of the things that I really learned from Gordon Clark, and continue to learn from him as I read his works, is the importance of defining your terms. It's really important to have a clear idea in mind what you're talking about. So when you use a term like oligarchy, you have to ask yourself, well, what do I mean by this? And of course, you as the listener also have to ask, well, what does he mean by that term oligarchy? And since that's the principal term in today's podcast, I wanted to define that for you a little bit. Oligarchy, and I'm using the Merriam-Webster dictionary that I have here in front of me, and the dictionary here, it gives three definitions of oligarchy, and I'll read them to you. The first definition of oligarchy is government by the few. If you happen to know a little bit of Greek, you might recognize the words that make up the term oligarchy. There are two Greek words. It's a compound word. The first word is oligos, which means a few, and of course archy, which comes from the Greek word for rule. So when you're talking about an oligarchy, you're talking about the rule of a few. And that's the basic definition of oligarchy. A second definition that the Merriam-Webster dictionary gives is this. It's a government in which a small group exercises control, especially for corrupt and selfish purposes. And the third definition is this, an organization under oligarchic control, also a group exercising such control. For the purposes of our discussion, we're going to be using definition number 2 of oligarchy, and that is a government in which a small group exercises control, especially for corrupt and selfish purposes. And really, when you look at the West today, you see oligarchy, and you see it really developing all over the place. You know, in the West, we like to speak of our democratic traditions, or more accurate, at least if you're talking here in the United States, this is not a democracy, it's a republic. But a republic is not an oligarchy. A constitutional republic, as we have, is supposed to be a country in which is governed ultimately by the rule of law. The rule of law has the final say, whereas in an oligarchy, you're talking about a small group of men, a small group of individuals who hold sway. And that's an important distinction to make. The distinction between laws, and a country governed by laws, and a country governed by a few individuals. So that's what oligarchy is. It's government by a few individuals, and usually it has the nuance that those few individuals are up to no good. Now, that's what oligarchy is. How about the why of oligarchy? As I mentioned, this is a word that really you never used to hear much of in the United States. People would say, well, it's a free country. You know, it's funny, you don't really hear people say that anymore. I don't remember the last time I heard somebody say, well, it's a free country. People seem to understand, even if they haven't thought deeply about it, that somehow things just aren't the way they used to be. So One way of talking about oligarchy, and maybe by way of leading into oligarchy, I wanted to provide you with a few examples, and sometimes examples are very helpful, not only to clarify meaning, but also I think to help explain or maybe lay the groundwork for talking about why we have oligarchy today. And really, these examples are things that come from some fairly recent news stories. There was recently a column that was written by Peggy Noonan. Some of you may be familiar with her work. She's been a pretty prominent American political writer over the last 30 to 35 years. I think she really got her big break in writing back in the days when Ronald Reagan was president. She was, I believe, his chief speechwriter. Well, today she writes editorial. She's a syndicated columnist, and one of her outlets is the Wall Street Journal. And she published a column just this past week in the Wall Street Journal. The title of the column's pretty interesting. It says, "How Global Elites Forsake Their Countrymen." And it's subtitled, "Those in Power See People at the Bottom as Aliens Whose Bizarre Emotions They Must Try to Manage." And it's actually a very insightful column. And when you read through it, what you see is a case of where people who are in positions of power are increasingly becoming aloof to the people that they claim to represent, the people they claim to govern. There's an interesting, I'm going to read a bit of the column here to you. It's a somewhat long quote, but I think it's appropriate here. And let me just read this section to you. Beginning of the quote, "Affluence detaches. Power adds distance to experience. I don't have it fully right in my mind, but something big is happening here with this division between the leaders and the led. It is very much a feature of our age, but it is odd that our elites have abandoned or are abandoning the idea that they belong to a country, that they have ties that bring responsibilities, that they should feel loyalty to their people, or, at the very least, a grounded respect." And she's talking here, of course, about globalism, but I think this really also applies, and really globalism and oligarchy, I think, are pretty closely intertwined concepts. But she's just talking about this idea that people who run countries really don't have a lot of regard for the well-being of the... she's right to point this out. And this is not a healthy development, not at all. This is not a Christian development. It's quite the opposite. And there are... I want to read you just a few examples of some stories here of exactly the type of thing Peggy Noonan is talking about. There was... And this appeared on Zero Hedge. Again, this was on August 14th. There is a piece on Zero Hedge that had this title. It said, "German President Booed, Attacked, Claims, quote, the people are the problem, not the elites." This fellow actually said that. His name, and to bear with me here a moment, my computer acted like it wants to freeze up on me. This fellow, he's a high official in Germany. His name is Joachim Gauck. And he was, back in June, he made an appearance in a German city, Sebnitz, in Saxony. Shortly before he made that appearance in Sebnitz, he had made a public statement. He said this, you know, quote, "The elites are not the problem." Of course, referring to himself, I guess obviously he's an elite. He says, "The elites are not the problem. The people are the problem." And I don't know the exact context of which he made those remarks, but of course, one of the major problems, if you follow the news at all, has been the refugee crisis that's taken place, not just in Germany, but perhaps especially in Germany, maybe more than most nations of Europe, where the country is being inundated with Middle Eastern refugees. You've had mass shootings, you've had suicide bombings, you've had rapes all over the place. I mean, violent crime, really truly violent crime, has just been almost, at times it seems like a weekly, maybe even a daily occurrence in Germany. It's just one horrifying headline after another. And I suspect maybe that Mr. Gauck, Joachim Gauck, Herr Gauck, maybe we should call him in German, I think he was probably reacting to some of the complaints of the German people about this. You know, I can't possibly imagine why the regular ordinary Germans would be upset about having their country overrun by third world immigrants who frankly are in some cases quite violent. And not only that, it's not just a matter of just having this massive wave of refugees coming in, but not only are the Germans suffering crimes as a result of these refugees, but they're having to pay for the privilege on top of that. There's a story out that the German government has taken out. It was like a 1.5 billion euro essentially raid on the public treasury, and I don't have the information here in front of me, but there's this massive amount of money that they have taken out of the public treasury and intend to use that to pay for medical expenses for all of these refugees. And so if you're a German taxpayer, not only are you being attacked and bombed and shot and having people running around saying Allahu Akbar, but you got to pay for the privilege on top of that. So, you know, I can't imagine why an ordinary German might be a little bit upset by that. actually, it's not hard at all to understand why they might be upset. But this fellow, this Joachim Gauck, well, he doesn't seem to think that there's any problem with that. It's the people that are the problem, certainly not the great and good and the wise and wonderful, such as himself. That's an example of oligarchy. It's a very arrogant top-down government. There was another story that appeared, and this was one that actually came up shortly after the Brexit vote. You may think back, it was on June 23rd. Brexit, that's one of those I don't know what you might call it, but it's kind of a nickname for the British exit from the European Union. There was a vote that was put to the voters in Great Britain on June 23rd as a referendum, and they could vote up or down whether they should stay in the European Union or whether they should go. I guess it was kind of maybe like the Clash, should they stay or should they go? And they voted to go. And after the British people voted to leave the European Union, this fellow by the name of James Traub, he's a member of, drumroll please, the Council on Foreign Relations, which everybody knows is one of the ultimate elite institutions for globalists anywhere. This James Traub actually wrote a piece in the Council on Foreign Relations in their Journal of Opinion. The Journal of Opinion, it's called Foreign Policy. And James Traub wrote an article with this title. It says, "It's time for the elites to rise up against the ignorant masses." That's just a stunning headline. The title of that is truly amazing. You know, this guy thinks that, you know, apparently, I guess, if anyone in Great Britain thinks that, you know, maybe being taxed to death and having your country, having unelected bureaucrats and the European Commission lord it over your country, and if you don't like that, if you're a British citizen, that somehow you're an ignorant. You're an ignoramus. You're a fool. You just don't get it. You know, the great and the good, the elites, I mean, they're the ones that get it, and your job is basically to sit down to shut up and pay sufficient obeisance to them. And when they say jump, you say how high. You know, don't you dare even consider voting against some of their ideas. And so this fellow, this James Traub, he rants in this article about how the elites need to push back on all of these ignoramuses with their pitchforks getting uppity. It's really quite extraordinary. And he doesn't, of course, confine his comments strictly to Brexit, but he talks here about some things in the United States. I'll read you a bit of a quote here from him. And this is quoting from James Traub. He says, quote, "The schism we see opening before us is not just about policies, but about reality. The Brexit forces won because cynical leaders were prepared to cater to voters' paranoia, lying to them about the dangers of immigration and the cost of membership in the EU. Some of those leaders have already begun to admit that they were lying. Donald Trump has, of course, set a new standard for disingenuousness and catering to voters' fears, whether over immigration or foreign trade or anything else he can think of. The Republican Party, already rife with science deniers and economic reality deniers, has thrown itself into the embrace of a man who fabricates realities that ignorant people like to inhabit." Did I say ignorant? Yes, I did. It is necessary to say that people are deluded and that the task of leadership is to undelude them. End quote. Thus, James Traub. This is an extraordinarily arrogant piece of journalism here. And the one thing that Traub and others of his ilk, you know, whether it's Joaquin Gauck or James Traub or any of these oligarch master of the universe types, the one thing that they never ever seem to ask is, why are they hated so much? You know, I mean, they just want to chalk it all up to apparently to ignorance. But they never seem to ever consider that maybe, possibly, there could be another explanation for that. They're so blinded by their own arrogance and by their own sense of entitlement, their own sense of greatness and goodness, that they can't seem to explain people rejecting their policies any other way. And they simply want to throw out the idea that somehow if anybody has concerns about immigration, if anybody has concerns about foreign trade deals, well, he's just an ignoramus. Clearly, he's just an ignoramus, and there's no reason to even take those people seriously. You know, these are people with those bizarre emotions whose ideas have to be managed from on high. Very strange stuff. Another example of oligarchy, in fact, maybe a couple of other examples, were in the U.S. presidential elections. Well, not the presidential elections, I should say the primaries. And this was true both on the Republican side and on the Democratic side. The Democratic National Committee bent over backwards to make sure that Hillary won the Democratic nomination. It's my opinion, you know, and I can't prove this out, but I am very strongly of the opinion that had the Democratic National Committee not had its great big thumb on the scales, that Bernie Sanders would have won, would have defeated Hillary Clinton for the nomination on the Democratic Party. And it was very, very obvious throughout the entire primary season that the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, that they really viewed the primary season as really sort of a coronation for Hillary Clinton. And everybody else there, well, they were just pretenders in the eyes of the DNC. And it was interesting, right before the Democratic Party held its convention in Philadelphia, that there was this WikiLeaks and released all of this trove of emails showing that, in fact, the Democratic National Committee was working overtime to ensure Hillary's victory and Bernie Sanders' defeat. So they actually were doing this. I mean, it was very obvious if you really followed the campaign at all that they were doing it. But then, of course, it came out in these emails. I guess you might call that the smoking gun evidence that proved it. On the Republican side, you had oligarchy. You had something very much similar to that. The Republican Party did everything they could to sabotage the candidacy of Donald Trump. They just did not like Donald Trump, and they were going to do everything they could to make sure that he failed. And one of my favorite examples of that sort of thing, it actually came in a fairly extraordinary interview that was on CNBC over the, it was back in March, I believe, and they had a gentleman on by the name of Curly Hoagland, I think is the way they pronounce his last name. He was a Republican muckety-muck of some sort from North Dakota, and he got on CNBC, and was being interviewed about the convention. And the point that he made, and he said this quite up front, he says, "We choose the nominee, not the voters." And by the "we," he was talking about the Republican National Committee. He was talking about the, you know, the party elders, so to speak. The interviewers were really taken aback by this. They asked him, "Well, why do you even bother to have primaries?" And Hoagland's response was, "Well, I don't know." Now, on one hand, I guess I would have to have some respect for Hoagland. At least he came out and spoke his mind. You know, he didn't waffle. He didn't leave us wondering where he stood on things. And so there's something to be said for at least being honest. I can respect that. On the other hand, it was incredibly arrogant. And it really underscored once again this idea that this oligarchic arrogance, this idea that everything is top down and that we, the great, the wise, and the good, know what's best, and the rest of you, you know, yokels out there with your pitchforks and what have you, your job is just to sit down, to shut up, and take whatever we dish out. And don't you dare think otherwise. And this is just incredibly arrogant stuff. And you have to ask yourself, well, where does this come from? Where does this come from? Why are we seeing so much of this right now? And you can say, well, I mean, it's always been around. And I think that there's some truth to that. I mean, we live in this sinful, fallen world. And governments everywhere tend in that direction. But in the West, at least in the, when I talk about the West, I'm talking about here specifically about those nations that were affected by the Reformation, the 16th century Christian Reformation. And in the nations of the West, that sort of thing is really frowned upon. And there's a reason for that. And it was this. The nations that were affected by the Reformation have a political philosophy, have a history about them that is directly opposed to the idea of oligarchy. In the 16th century, the widespread preaching of and belief in the gospel of Jesus Christ, that is the gospel of justification by faith alone, had a tremendous impact on society. One of the implications of the gospel is the idea that the government is a servant of the people. The idea of government as a servant is a Christian idea. That is not something that's derived from Greece or Rome. That's a Christian idea. And when society, when you had large numbers of people come to understand and believe the gospel, it not only saved individual men and women, but it changed society as a whole. And, you know, we have this idea that, well, of course government should be a servant of the people. It's just common sense. Well, that's actually not a common sense idea. That's a Christian idea. And I would refer you to the passage out of the Gospel of Luke. This is Luke chapter 22, and I'm just going to read this passage here to you briefly. It says this. Now, there was also a dispute among them, talking about the disciples. There was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And he, that is Jesus, and he said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves." So this passage right here really does provide the basis of the idea of government as servant. Government as a servant is the exact opposite of government as oligarchy. You know, these oligarchs think that it's their job to make pronouncements, and when they say jump, you say how high. On the other hand, Christian government, Republican, that's with a small r, Republican government, is all about the government serving the people, ensuring that their property and that their persons are safe, ensuring that justice is carried out, ensuring that the laws of the nation are in accord with the law of God, with the Ten Commandments. That's the job of the government. And beyond that, they don't government officials, the magistrate, the civil government does not have authority. It has the authority to do a couple of things, to punish evildoers and to praise the good, as the New Testament points out to us. That's the job of government, and that's what the government does. When the government does those things, the government is serving the people. The government's not lording it over people. You know what Jesus said here? Go back to what he said here. This is Luke 22, verse 25. The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. So, I mean, they exercise lordship. They lord it over people. They say, you know, hey, you know, I'm Caesar or I'm Pharaoh, and your job is to bow down before me and do what I tell you to do. And you don't have an option. And if you don't like it, well, you know, you might just be thrown in some horrible prison, or maybe I'll just execute you. So the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and not only do they exercise lordship, not only do they lord it over people, but they like to be called benefactor, too. A number of ancient kings, especially in the Greek-speaking world, they had the title euergetes. Euergetes is simply the Greek form of benefactor. And so they like to be known as benefactor, you know, so-and-so benefactor. You know, because they I guess they liked to boast about the good works, you know, so they acted like these, like lord and master, and they lorded authority over people, but then on top of that, they wanted everybody to know, well, what great people they are. So not only are they lording their authority over you, but they want to be praised for doing that. And that's quite an extraordinary thing. And you know, when you think about it, it's really not all that different from what's going on in today's world. I mean, you look at people like, again, Joaquin Gauck. He thinks he's doing praiseworthy work. You know, he and people like Angela Merkel, they want to bring all of these immigrants in. They want to create all of this. They create this huge problem. And then they like to pat themselves on the back and talk about what great humanitarians they are. You know, meanwhile, of course, their people are suffering. They're being bombed and shot and terrorized and raped. But you know, Angela Merkel, I mean, she apparently seems to think she's a pretty good person. And Joaquin Gauck apparently thinks he's a pretty good guy. And they expect praise for all of this. And they don't understand that people are actually upset. You know, and Merkel and Gauck and others of that ilk, James Traub, for instance, they all believe in lording it over people, and they want to be praised for that. So, you know, what we have here, we know what oligarchy is. It's the rule of a few people, and usually for sort of nefarious purposes as well, self-serving purposes. And we know, we've seen some examples of oligarchy. The actions and some of the words of some politicians recently, or at least people who are very influential. And we've also seen what the Bible has to say about that. The Bible condemns oligarchy. You know, that's not Christian government. I guess the last point that I wanted to make about this is you would ask yourselves, well, why is this happening now? Well, this goes back to the idea of, you know, when there was the widespread preaching and belief of the gospel in the 16th century, it changed people's hearts, and it changed society as a whole. But I think most people would agree with this, that the West, pick any country in the West, I know about the United States simply because I live here, is less Christian than what it was in the past. And as Christianity loses its hold on the hearts, on the minds of people, it shouldn't surprise anyone that Christian ideas begin to be removed from society one by one by one. And we've seen this continued pattern now for, I'd say, well over 100 years in the West. And we're at the point where the state of decay is pretty advanced. And you're really seeing it come out in this tendency toward oligarchy. And I think that's really what underlies it all, is the disappearance of Christianity has paved the way for the appearance of oligarchs and oligarchy. So, wish I had. That's kind of a depressing way to end the show. I realize that. That's maybe not the most hopeful thing in the world. But, you know this. Again, and I've talked about this before, that no matter how bad things get, no matter how frustrating things get, we have to have hope, because we know who sits at the right hand of God the Father. The Lord Jesus Christ does. God is in control. He's not going to change. And he hears the prayers of those who call upon him in the name of his Son, Christ Jesus. And we know that all things, whatever happens, however bad things get, however frustrating things get, and I know I certainly get pretty frustrated when I watch the news, but no matter how frustrating things get, that all those things work together for good, for those who love God and for those who are called according to his purpose. And with that, I will wrap up, and Lord willing, talk to you next week.